7:30 UTC on Friday, December 8th, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
You must apologize to our clients and then offer to pay them compensation for the period of unlawful detention.
That was the defense attorney for former Finance Minister Ignatius Chombo. We'll have that story and more coming up.
Good evening, I'm Kutanai Mutetwa.
And I'm Mike Horvitz on VOA's Zimbabwe Today.
On the surface, a lot has changed in Zimbabwe in the past month. Longtime President Robert Mugabe resigned after 37 years in power, and the new administration has vowed to usher in a new era. But prominent Zimbabwean analysts say the new administration will not be much different from the one that it replaced. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
New President Emmerson Mnangagwa has hailed his ascension as the dawn of a new era, and this week introduced a national budget that reverses some of the most notable and controversial economic policies created by his predecessor, Robert Mugabe. Not so fast, say prominent Zimbabwean analysts who argue that the new government is hardly a change at all. After all, the new president was for decades Mugabe's right-hand man. Kutukwashi Chitsike directs the Research and Advocacy Unit, a Zimbabwe-based think tank.
We've changed the driver, but it's the same bus. So what major difference is Mnangagwa going to bring for us? I don't see much change.
Ibo Mandaza, a prominent academic and author, says he's disappointed that the international community avoided describing the military-led action that prompted Mugabe's resignation as a coup. Calling it that, he said, might have brought in real change, like a more diverse cabinet with more opposition voices, not just ruling party stalwarts and military men in top positions.
Most of them, like SADC, like South Africa, would have wanted a transitional government. It's a way of disguising the coup. That has not happened at all. On the contrary, you have a reassertion, nay, an overassertion of the coup. The man who announced the coup, Sibusiso Moyo, is now Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade.
The analysts expressed concern that while Mnangagwa has promised to hold elections as planned in mid-2018, his close relationship with the military means the armed forces may try to influence the outcome. And so, just weeks after the most startling change Zimbabwe has seen in decades, Mandaza and other analysts are calling for even more change.
But given the new reality in which it's just change of the driver, and we have virtually military rule, I think it offers an opportunity for all of us, the region, the international community, together with the national situation, to demand a transitional government and to reform, political and economic reforms are taken. Otherwise, I can't see how we can sustain the situation we have in Zimbabwe at the moment.
For a nation that has been through so much in the past few weeks and years, these are harsh words indeed. But analysts say change is never easy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The defense attorney for Zimbabwe's former finance minister and a top youth leader alleges that they were tortured under military detention and held illegally. A court granted both men bail yesterday. Attorney Lovemore Maduku spoke with VOA's Frank Chikore from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The military detained Zimbabwe's former finance minister, Ignatius Chombo, and the former youth leader of the ruling ZANU-PF party, Kudzanai Chipanga, during last month's military intervention in this southern African country. Chombo is charged with fraud, corruption, and abuse of office during former President Robert Mugabe's administration. Chipanga is accused of causing disaffection among the country's defense forces. Their arrest was carried out during an army blitz that targeted what it calls criminals who allegedly surrounded the country's now deposed leader. High Court Judge Edith Mushore ordered the duo to be released on bail. Chombo was ordered to post $5,000 in bail money, to report to the police three times a day, and to surrender title deeds of his house as well as travel documents. He also is barred from the central bank and government offices where the offenses were allegedly committed. Chipanga was ordered to post $500 as bail and to report to the police twice daily. Their defense attorney, Love Momaduku, says his clients should not have been arraigned in the first place because their detention was unconstitutional.
The High Court criticized the Magistrates Court and said they were wrong to have denied this person's bail because they were very fit candidates for bail. But the High Court did not just end there. It went further to say that those persons that had arrested them before they were taken by the police, that is the military, they had acted in an unlawful manner because they had gone beyond the 48-hour rule.
Maduku claims the army tortured his clients while they were in detention.
Very clearly so. They are actually torture. That's torture. Torture is any form of pain that you inflict on a person with a view to wanting them to either do something in an unlawful manner. So even blindfolding, keeping a person blindfolded for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, when you are doing that against their will, that's torture. Assaulting them when in custody, that's torture. And as they were doing that, they were trying to extract certain information from them.
Maduku says his clients will seek compensation from the new government of Mugabe's former deputy, President Emmerson Mnangagwa.
What next lawfully is that we first expect that the government will come out and tell us that, look, we were sorry we did this and here we are offering compensation. They must apologize to our clients and then offer to pay them compensation for the period of unlawful detention. But if they do not do that, we'll take them up on that issue. At the same time, we'll take it into account when this matter is going to be taken up. Should they try and try our clients on these charges, that would be relevant.
Chombo and Chipanga are among the highest profile former officials detained by the military since it acted last month. Both are linked to the Generation 40 faction of the ruling ZANU-PF party, which was close to both President Mugabe and his wife, Grace Mugabe. Since he resigned on November 21st, Mugabe has not been seen in public. Some of his allies reportedly have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Frank Chikowore for VOA News, Harare.
The High Court in Harare today delayed the trial of an American woman accused of undermining the authority of former President Robert Mugabe. Martha O'Donovan's trial is now set to begin January 4th. O'Donovan denies the charges, which are based on a Twitter post the prosecutor says she sent. She was arrested early last month before the military took control of the government and Mugabe resigned. She is currently free on bail but not able to leave the country. O'Donovan works for Magamba Network, which produces satirical content.
Zimbabwe's budget for the coming year projects economic growth for about 4.5% and offers changes that bring hope to some citizens. Reporter Kudzai Zrinayashi says Zimbabweans get to feel what they want. Reporter Kudzai Zrinayashi speaks to Zimbabweans to get a feel of what they think about the budget.
Zimbabwe's administration has left the broken country cautiously optimistic, hoping for a vibrant economy and other things that make a great nation. But President Emmerson Mnangagwa's new budget leaves some people frustrated. Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and other political events.
Listen, I'm a little bit pessimistic about this budget. Chinamasa was just cybersecurity minister a couple of weeks ago. Now he's back as finance minister. I don't even know if he knows what he read today and if he's got the time to implement it.
Yasmin Tofu is a member of parliament for Bulawayo Metropolitan. She says the budget doesn't represent women.
Looking at the budget, I'm actually very disappointed at the fact that women have not been considered in this budget. And also, when you look at the health budget, it was very, very low.
In the budget, health is $408 million. Defense is $420 million. Higher education is $363 million. Agriculture is $497 million. While $132.2 million are set aside for elections, critics say Zimbabwe continues to fail to reach its pledge of allocating at least 15% of the national budget to health. The finance minister said public officers above 65 years will have to retire and a voluntary retirement plan will be initiated. Perks to high-ranking government officials have been significantly cut. Praise Kureya works for a wholesale business. He is among those who are encouraged.
From the reading, it looks promising. There were a lot of changes that Chinamasa, the Minister of Finance, promised to change. So it's a promising budget, and it looks like the liberal budget, which is actually trying to level the ground for investors to come into the country.
The budget also scrapes the controversial Indigenization Act that stipulated any company in Zimbabwe should be 51% locally owned. The act remains in the diamond and platinum extraction. Kureya adds there will be limited time to implement the budget.
It's really a good budget, but now the challenge is when you look at the time that the new ZANU-PF government is expected to implement that budget, also the coming in of the elections. I think on timing, that's where the challenge is going to come from, because there's little time left and they have to implement that budget before the election.
Zimbabwe is due to hold elections by next August, meaning President Mnangagwa's administration will be under pressure to shock the economy back to life and implement much-needed reforms. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinamashe from Harare.
You're watching, you're listening to Zimbabwe Today, live from Voice of America Studio 22. I'm Kudzai Mutetwa in Washington. At 41 past the hour, we continue with news about Zimbabwe's political change. Despite the recent political changes in Zimbabwe, the hard work of removing unexploded mines from the country continues. Tom Bibb is the Zimbabwe Program Director for Halo Trust, an international demining organization. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about how much needs to be done to clear the land.
So Zimbabwe's landmine problem dates back to the Liberation War of the 1970s, with the bulk of the landmines being laid by the Rhodesian forces who tried to sort of seal off the entire northern and eastern border of the country. So in terms of mine numbers, it's one of the most highly impacted countries in the world, with some of the densest minefields to be found anywhere. In terms of area, it's not as big as other countries. It's approximately 65 square kilometers are affected. But that's a very long, thin barrier stretching over literally hundreds of kilometers of border.
Now, what is needed to clear it in terms of both domestic effort by the Zimbabwe government and international effort?
I mean, the great thing about Zimbabwe is there's a very dedicated government behind it. There's a National Mine Action Center and a Mine Action Authority that's put together a national strategic plan that aims to have the entire country cleared by the end of 2025. Now, it's a very feasible plan, but it needs buy-in from the donor community as well. And sort of estimates according to the strategy from 2018 until the end of 25 is going to require about $120 million to get the job done. Now, there are lots of people willing to work. We've already got very well-established clearance agencies. There's Halo Trust. There's another British organization, MAG. Norwegian People's Aid are also here. So there is capacity in country, but they need continued funding at existing levels, and we actually need to increase capacity somewhat in order to get the job done.
When you say increased capacity, are you talking about increasing the number of personnel? What are you talking about?
Yeah, primarily increasing the number of personnel. It is a very labor-intensive process, and one of the very positive spin-offs from that is we try and recruit from the mine-affected district, so the people who've had to live with this threat their entire lives actually benefit from employment during the clearance process.
What are Halo Trust operations there in Zimbabwe? How many people do you have on staff? What all are you working on? Are there particular areas that are your focus?
So So we currently have a total of 370 Zimbabwean staff. We are centered in Mashonaland Central Province, which extends up to the northern border with Mozambique, and that's where our operations are at the moment. So far in 2017, we've cleared over 16,000 landmines, which to sort of break that down into something more manageable, for instance, yesterday we cleared 159 mines just in a single day. And it really is day in, day out, lots of local people working up on the border, doing a very risky job, but freeing up land that can be used by the communities for agriculture, grazing, and access to water sources.
That was Tom Dibb with the Halo Trust speaking with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
I want to express my outrage and utter heartbreak at last night's attack on the United Nations peacekeepers in the DRC. Early indications from the site of the attack in North Kivu indicate that at least 12 Tanzanian peacekeepers were killed and at least 40 injured, four of them critically. And we also understand that at least 5 members of the armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo were killed. I offer my deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims and to the government and people of Tanzania, and I wish a speedy recovery to all those injured. I condemn this attack unequivocally, and these deliberate attacks against UN peacekeepers are unacceptable and constitute a war crime.
That is United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressing his outrage after an attack on UN peacekeepers in the eastern DRC that killed at least a dozen Tanzanian peacekeepers and injured 40 more. A UN official told VOA that the attack on the mission's forward operating base in Semoliki in Benin territory was likely perpetrated by the Ugandan rebel group, the Allied Democratic Forces, which is active in the area and has attacked the mission in the past month. DRC government spokesman Lambert Mende says his government also thinks the ADF forces are responsible. The peacekeepers were part of a special intervention force based in eastern Congo.
The World Health Organization reports rapid action has succeeded in bringing an outbreak of Marburg virus in Uganda under control and prevented the spread of this deadly disease just a matter of weeks after it was first detected. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The first case of this deadly disease in Uganda was confirmed on October 17th. Laboratory tests found the death of a 50-year-old woman was due to an infection caused by the Marburg virus. World Health Organization spokeswoman Fadela Shaib says her agency immediately got to work as soon as it was notified.
Within 24 hours of being informed by the Ugandan Health Authorities in early October, WHO deployed a rapid response team to the remote mountainous area, and we helped finance the immediate support and scale up the response in Uganda and Kenya.
WHO released $623,000 from its emergency fund to finance this action. Marburg is a highly fatal disease caused by a virus from the same family as that of Ebola. It can be transmitted from person to person by bodily fluids and can cause bleeding, fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and other symptoms. Shaib tells VOA this was the fifth outbreak of Marburg virus in the past decade, so Uganda knows what to do when the disease strikes. But she says important lessons also have been learned from the West African Ebola epidemic that killed more than 11,000 people.
Marburg is very infectious. It was also important to trace all the contacts of this first case and to follow them for a period of 21 days, plus 21 days, just to make sure that there is no other cases being detected.
WHO reports three people died over the course of the outbreak, which affected two districts in eastern Uganda near the Kenyan border. The UN agency notes surveillance and contact tracing on the Kenyan side of the border by the Kenyan Ministry of Health and partners also prevented cross-border spread of the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Writer and professor Alain Patrice Kanan has been held in a police station in Douala, Cameroon since Wednesday. His attorney, Emmanuel Sim, tells VOA's French to Africa service that Kanan was arrested at the airport as he was leaving the country. Sim says Kanan, who lives in the United States, was arrested because of an online post in which he criticized the president of the country. Under Cameroon law, such critical comments could result in a sentence of up to 5 years. Sim was able to see Kanan for the first time today, but the writer's family and friends have not been able to see him. The lawyer says a hearing is scheduled for tomorrow.
Family Planning 2020, a global partnership that empowers women and girls to decide for themselves how many children they have, released a new report this week that shows progress in the world's poorest countries. In its annual progress report, it was found that the use of modern contraception between July 2016 and July 2017 prevented 84 million unintended pregnancies, 26 million unsafe abortions, and 125,000 maternal deaths. Beth Schlater, Executive Director of Family Planning 2020, spoke with our colleague, Kim Lewis, about the significance of the report.
Well, we put out an annual report that measures the use of contraception in the 69 lowest-income countries of the world. We put this report out every year. So this year, we've measured that in these 69 countries, there are now almost 310 million women and girls who have access to and are using modern forms of contraception. And that's about 38.8 million more than when we started measuring progress in 2012. So there's been some significant uptake.
Yes, that sounds very promising. So how are African women responding to the use of contraception?
So Africa was the region of the world that was farthest behind in terms of having access to comprehensive reproductive health programs and contraception in particular. So we've actually seen amazing growth in Africa relative to other regions. We still need to do a lot of work to make sure that we're providing more access to African women. But even though the population in Africa is much smaller compared to Asia, almost half of the growth that we're seeing is in African countries. So there are 16 million additional women and girls who are now able to use contraception in Africa, with South and East Africa growing faster.
Can you name some of the countries where they're using the contraception?
Yeah, well, it's actually across the continent where we've seen growth. There's another partnership that we work with that focuses on West African countries that have the lowest contraceptive rates, and that's where we've seen some amazing uptake in the last 5 or 6 years. They set a goal for themselves to increase by 1 million over a 5-year period, and they exceeded that ahead of time and are continuing to grow. So where we're seeing a lot of development indicators across the board, education, water and sanitation, all of those things that are very complicated, we see lower health rates as well. So that partnership focusing on the area where there's a lot of infrastructure work to do has seen really great growth.
How are women accessing the contraception, and what forms of contraception are they using?
So we try to make sure that women have a wide range of methods so that they're able to use short-term methods if they're looking to space their birth, so making sure that pills are available. We're looking particularly, though, to make sure that long-acting methods are available, and that's a sea change for women and girls. Injectables, and in particular, IUDs and implants, where if a woman wants to space or limit the number of children she has for a number of years, she can use one of these long-term methods and then just be assured that she's safe. We also make sure that condoms are available in all places because we recognize the need for dual protection, so that we're making sure that women can control when they get pregnant and that they're protected from sexually transmitted infections as well.
Are there any cultural barriers that are making the use of contraception more challenging?
Yes, cultural barriers, in fact, are some of the most persistent challenges that women face, not only in terms of knowing about contraception, but receiving contraception and being able to go there, having their families accept it, having the men in their lives, religious leaders, mothers-in-law accept it, but also when they go for the services themselves to ensure that all women and girls who feel they are in need of contraception can receive that. We've seen some amazing changes, however. One of the programs that we work with is the Gates Foundation has the Nigeria Urban Reproductive Health Initiative. And in northern Nigeria, what they found is that the number one and two reasons that women cite for not using contraception are that they believe that God will take care of whether or not they get pregnant, and they believe there are religious prohibitions against using contraception. So in working with religious leaders to provide information from core documents such as the Bible or the Quran and helping them to understand that there is an open space for this that's allowed with in religion, we've seen some of the resistance to that drop by rates as high as 50% when those messages come from religious leaders themselves. So culture, religion, family dynamics, all of those issues are really relevant to whether or not women can actually access and use contraception.
That was Beth Slater, Executive Director of Family Planning 2020. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Washington.
One guy, but when the vendor when they see a nigga drive by, Shabar Kuimba just to blow. I mean, I don't know why. The kind of second Shaka woman gets a vana dry. Manual the papa, Vesalana, Kananana, my. Then my paper, then my TV, Mesa Shamba Sai. I'm on the Zora Tango Sara, Tingo Room is dry. Entertain and I'm going to go to the dry. But so on, I'm going to come first one with the Kamai. Dedicate Yaku Nuang and Yamaya, why? Shandela would. You can't beat me in anyone would just try. And if you never put it by then, I don't lie. My words are with a sugar. Victory, not with
you.
Kanariri Godo Godo Reshanje. That was Stunner. And that's it on this evening on VOA's Zimbabwe Today, guys. I am Michael Hove.
And I'm Kudzanai Mutetwa. We'll be back again Monday at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Dabele broadcast can be heard at 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook on Studio 7, VOA Ndebele, and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com. And we leave you again with Kodo by Stana. Jump on my bottles, Zimmy. You throw away Naya, keep me on top of your shoulders. Naramera in the summer, commander to the soldiers. Kodo, Kodo, Surai, Tanji.
Clarence exclusive.
dzura neoira zvimbomixana never kubudai pandiri kunge ndebvu dzanda sheva tambira ikure this is big boy business sazoira cash wangu hahina kana weakness lyrical I'm starting my simba physically no zimba vari kutarisira inini kunge mukadzi ane mimba munhu wepfupi ano rengatarenda 12 months ndiri pachati ndini wacho karenda hei riro lavit nakugara mumaspika nzira yangu ndakuiona manje manje ndendasvika matanga yese ini ndimi ndekanzombe from ashes to classes kana itim hombe
todo toraitanzira